We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Last Friday, a tsunami and the major earthquake that preceded it devastated a large section of Japan's northeastern coast. Loss of power that resulted led to an ongoing crisis at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, where partial meltdowns may have occurred in two separate reactors, and authorities there continue the effort to try to keep the reactors and also spent fuel stored on site from overheating. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll try to get a better understanding of what's happened in Japan, talk about what that might mean for the nuclear industry in other countries, including the United States. And we have with us in the studio two guests, James Stubbins and Rizwan Uddin. And they are both professors in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois. And we're pleased to have them here in the studio. Questions are welcome, certainly. As always, we hope people can be on topic and try to be brief, and that way we can get in as many callers as possible. But certainly folks who are listening are welcome to call with their questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And also we have email if you'd like to send in your question that way. The address is will-talk. That's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, you're welcome to give us a call. And thank you both very much for being here.
Good morning. Appreciate it. We're happy to be here.
I don't know. Right at the beginning, I want to get too heavy into reactor design, but I think it might be good just to start at a very basic point so people – to make sure they have an understanding of what the problem is, and that is to talk about this particular kind of reactor and how it works. And essentially, as I understand it, what happens in this kind of reactor is you have your chain reaction. That produces heat. That heat is used to boil water. That's why they call it a boiling water reactor. Water turns to steam. Steam turns turbine. Turbine generates electricity. And then that water comes back.
It's recondensed
and
comes back.
And essentially, so the water does two jobs. It makes your electricity, but it also keeps your reactor cool.
Yeah, in fact, it actually does a third job, which is to slow the neutrons down so they react better inside the reactor. So this is one of the major reasons the water's there.
Okay.
So it has two functions inside the reactor core. But you're right in saying that the primary issue here is the cooling of the fuel.
Yeah.
These reactors are a very popular type, particularly in Japan. But even in the U.S., about a third of the reactors are these boiling water reactors. And they have this specific characteristic that the water is boiled inside the reactor, in the core of the reactor, and the steam is taken out the top. There's also a continuous circulation of water inside the reactor in addition to the steam that goes out to the turbine and then recondensed and then back into the system. And there are a number of other safety systems associated with keeping water in the reactor in these cases.
Yeah. And it seems that in this particular case that the critical issue here was loss of power. And that resulted in the inability to continue to circulate the water to keep the reactor cool. Apparently, when the earthquake hit, the plant shut down as it was supposed to do. So that wasn't so much an issue as it was the loss of electrical power to the electrical power plant.
Yes, and these plants are prepared for that eventuality. And as you say, as soon as the earthquake hit, the control rods went into the reactor to shut the reactor down, which is normal. This is not even an operator-initiated event. This is something that happens just naturally under any kind of condition like that. And then what should happen is the backup power should come on, if necessary, to help remove the heat that's remaining in the reactor core. So the way the fission process works, it splits atoms apart, but the atoms that are, once they're split, the ones that are remaining, the ones that are formed in that reaction still are radioactive, a lot of them, and they're still generating a lot of heat on their own. And so this after heat is the major issue to try and get this out of the reactor. by continuing to circulate in the best case to continue to circulate water through the reactor. In less good situations, at least to have water in the reactor that may be circulating and helping cool and covering the fuel rods.
Yeah. And here in this particular case, the plant did have backup systems to do this, but I guess the thinking is that they probably were damaged by the tsunami, and so they worked for a while, but then they quit.
Yes. And actually, these backup systems, they're redundant and other things, but evidently because of the tsunami, it knocked all of that excess power out. There were some battery systems that worked, but of course we know batteries don't work forever. They tend to get drained, and if you don't have a way to recharge them, that doesn't completely help either. But this loss of on-site power has been a major issue.
Yeah, maybe I can add the way it works would be, you know, the first thing that happens after you lose the grid power, you start your diesel generator. Not just this reactor, every reactor is supposed to have a backup system in the form of a diesel generator. And then if something happens to that diesel generator, then you have battery power. Of course, the batteries will only last so long, but the diesel generator is supposed to long for a reasonable period of time so that you can actually keep the reactor cooled. In this particular case, well, you have to make sure that you have enough diesel for the diesel generator, and it is going into the diesel generator. When the tsunami hit, actually, apparently, that was compromised because the storage tank for the diesel generator, that got contaminated with water. And in addition to that, I think some of the electrical circuits also got short-circuited because of the water. And so the combination of those two basically took the diesel generator out. The batteries kicked in for some period of time, then they got drained.
Yeah. I have a caller here, and I tell you what, why don't we go ahead and get this caller, because it's someone who said they were on a cell and they could only hold for a couple of minutes. So I will not wait them hold. I got plenty of questions. I will not make them hold on. We'll go to them. Line number one right here. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Maybe a silly question, but, you know, they're having problems cooling the fuel rods and things like that. And is it possible to drop some sort of a super cooled liquid like liquid nitrogen on them rather than just using water? That's my question. Thanks.
So thank you for the question. I don't think there are any silly questions. But in this case, I think a thermal shock that you might get by dropping something so cold onto the system might actually cause more damage than it would help. You would really rather inject water that maybe is not even completely cold in these systems. But I think even if you can inject warm water and keep it circulating or keep it things covered, that would be the best scenario.
Yeah. And it's sort of my understanding what they have been doing now all along is a stopgap kind of solution. The ultimate solution would be to restore electrical power to the plants, which is something that they are working on doing, but it's unclear just how long that's going to take.
Evidently, they're close. The reports yesterday and today say they're hoping to have power restored today, but I haven't heard for certain that that's happened.
But I was going back for a moment to the diesel and battery backups that are there in case the grid collapses completely and a plant doesn't have the electricity to do the cooling. So it's my understanding that these systems, while they are in place, they're not designed to keep the plant going for a week. They're designed to operate over a relatively short period of time.
Well, in these cases there are multiple diesels, so there is even some redundancy in the diesel engines, and I think the plan is that if necessary they could be refueled. So once the diesel is operating, there's no reason why you couldn't bring more fuel in most cases in, and keep the diesel running. In fact, these plants test the diesels very regularly, usually every week or maybe even more frequently and to ensure that they have this backup power going all the time. So I think this has been the major issue. I don't think people had planned evidently for this kind of set of scenarios or a set of events that would lead to a scenario where the diesel engines were so compromised as they seem to have been.
Well, I suppose that invites the question, well, when you're planning for a disaster, how do you think about what's likely to happen, and how do you prepare for an event where the probability might be quite low, but where the probability is also not zero?
Yes, and I think that's a good question, and that's a pervasive question across all kinds of industries, the airline industry, everything. And I think that what's the history has been that as these scenarios come to light, people start to think about what to do to prevent those possibilities. But it's always difficult to anticipate every kind of major problem that might come of this sort. Hmm.
And in some ways, I guess the way these things are calculated are how likely is a particular type of event. Now we are hearing this is a 300-year event, the kind of tsunami that hit, that followed the earthquake. It is clear that the height of the wave that came with the tsunami, that was not anticipated. Another meter-high wall, there is already a wall there to protect from the tsunami water, but it was 6.5 meters, and the tsunami came at 7 meters high, and hence the water went over and into the diesel and so on. Mm-hmm. So had this been anticipated, or if they had been a little bit more conservative, it is quite possible that we might not have been sitting here today. Some of the very, very simple things might have avoided the scenario. The fact that either the diesel generator got compromised or the supply of the diesel fuel itself got compromised, that might have been possible to actually handle that better by just having more secure lines and the storage tank at a height where water would not get into it.
Just to go back just for a second, let me ask you one other question. We talked about the fact that when the earthquake hit, the plant was automatically shut down, which is
correct.
Which is the way it's supposed to work. So that would mean that the fuel rods would be pushed in, right?
The control rods. In this case, actually, they come up from the bottom.
Whichever thing that they do, that happens, and then that means that then the nuclear chain reaction should stop.
Yes.
But that they're still hot. How long do they, after the nuclear reaction stops, how long do the elements there in the reactor stay hot?
Well, there are a couple ways to answer that question. As soon as the reactor shut down, the power level that's retained in the reactor core goes down to about 6 or 7% of what it was to start with. And so you have to imagine these are very energetic systems. There's a lot of stored energy, and so going from 100% to 6% is still a lot of energy to remove. After that, it starts to fall off exponentially. So it starts after a day, it's gone down a lot, and the next day even a lot more. And so if you can start to cool, so back to this issue about how long the diesel generators have to run, even if they ran for a few days, this is probably a normal situation, enough to keep the heat removed and have everything back to what would be cold, a cool status in these cases.
Yeah, so even when they go down to much less than 1%, even much less than 1% of 2,000 or 3,000 megawatt of thermal energy is a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. So the way I would put it is that, for comparison, if you look at the spent fuel pool in which the fuel was removed from the reactor core, the reaction stopped months and possibly years ago, that continues to generate enough heat actually to get the water to boil actually. At atmospheric pressure. So we are talking about two different pressures, but there is enough heat being generated that we continue to actually have to cool the spent fuel pool using an active system. It is not just dipped underwater.
Yeah.
So in the case of the reactor core, which was shut down 3, 4, 5 days ago, there is enough heat still being generated because of this decay process that we do need to cool it down for a significant number of days. What has happened now is that the first 3 or 4 days when you could have taken a lot of heat out, that has not happened. So that stored heat, because the diesel generator sort of failed right after tsunami hit. Mm-hmm. And so that stored heat is causing extra difficulty. Yeah. But once we have the power, once they get the power restored, the recirculation starts, I think it can continue for some days. It will need to be continue for days and months.
Yeah. Well, that gets to another important issue. I'm sure a core meltdown is a bad thing. You don't want that to happen. But there seems to be a concern also, and maybe greater concern, need for greater concern, about the issue of the water in these pools where there is spent fuel. They also have to be kept cool. And as you said, here in reactor number four, this is a reactor that had been shut down for maintenance. It wasn't even operating. They took the fuel out, and it was in this storage pool. And now, I think just yesterday, an official here, I think that was the head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Agency, essentially said it was their thinking that all of the water in that pool at reactor four might have evaporated. The nuclear company, the Tokyo Electric Company, they won't confirm that. But there's concern.
I think they've refuted that. So this is another one of the real issues in the whole evolving event, right. Is the information is often contradictory and often not very much. So it's very difficult to draw kind of broad conclusions about what's going on with just little pieces of information, it seemed to be.
But that, again, I think that speaks to this issue of how long the fuel stays hot. I mean, if this fuel was actually taken out, I don't know when it was taken out of the reactor, but if it was taken out of the reactor, if it's still hot enough to make the water boil so that it is possible that water could evaporate away, and then you would have this material exposed, that's much worse because there's no containment.
Yes, above the stored fuel pool. This is where the secondary containment would normally cover it, but in at least in the unit four, where this is the major concern, that outer structure, which has blown away from units one and three, is at least damaged at unit four, and so this is another concern.
And this would be another concern that we would have, say, here in the United States or elsewhere. Because here in this country, we have plants where they're storing spent fuel in these kind of pools on site because we don't have a permanent storage site. How much of a concern should that be or would that be here, say, in the United States?
Well, I think part of the situation in Unit 4, it's a very special situation. It's one that most reactors don't see. And this is what was done in this period where they planned to service that reactor is they took all of the fuel out of the reactor. Mm-hmm. In most cases, when you do a fuel change, you take about a third of the fuel out and replace that third. The third that you took out goes to the spent fuel pool and sits there with the other thirds that you've taken out in previous and typically a year before, maybe a year and a half or 2 years before. So you're taking out only a fraction of the reactor fuel at a time. Now, it seems, though I'm not sure we have good confirmation of this, that they took all of the fuel out. I'm sure they took all of the fuel out of the core. Where they actually put it in that pool, or there were some transfers to other pools I've heard as well. That total core loading of fuel would generate more heat than the one-third that you might take out in a normal refueling outage. Mm. And so the heat generated there is probably much larger than what you'd expect in any one of the plants that did normal refueling, like the ones typically the way it's done in the U.S., for instance.
Well, would that, though, if you had a situation where you had some problem at a plant, say a plant here in the United States, where you lost the water for whatever reason in your pool where you're storing your spent fuel, that would be a problem, right?
Yes, that should be a problem. And I think for many people, including us, the first concern with these spent fuel pools was not that the water would evaporate. This seemed less likely than an event where you would get some crack in the pool structure and have the water drain out. Now, if this happens in a normal situation, you put more water in until you can control the leak. But if you can't add more water, then this becomes even more problematic, I think, than the scenario we seem to be seeing now where people are worried about boiling and the evaporation process, kind of controlling the levels.
Well, I have several callers here, and I want to get to callers. One more question I'll ask at this point. From what you have seen and what we're able to know about what happened in Japan, for the design and construction of reactors or perhaps anything that you might do in the way of retrofitting, what do you think are the important lessons to be taken away?
Well, I think the first lesson is the issue about ensuring whatever happens that you have substantial, reliable backup power to run the pumps and to have a source of water. So they have a source of water. This hasn't been the issue. The real issue is the loss of the backup power. In addition, this issue about short circuits and other kinds of things, can you have the electrical system which controls the pumps and makes the plant operate, even probably gives you information about the radiation monitors that you have in the plant and other kinds of information that would be critical for controlling the situation. I think that's the second level that you would be really concerned that operated under any circumstance.
Yeah, I think I don't think the nuclear engineers were thinking about, you know, something like that would be happening, but they do realize that there was a cost associated with providing these backup systems to backup systems to backup systems. And this has been reflected in new reactor designs. In fact, three of the newer reactors in Japan, which have not been built yet in the U.S., but these are American-designed, American-built reactors in Japan, they rely on natural circulation. So they do not rely on backup powers. In the case of an accident, there's a body of water that is stored inside the core, inside the reactor building, and that water goes into the core, and it's in a closed loop, and it is designed in such a way that you don't need a pump to circulate the water. So the same water just keeps on circulating, going through the core, getting out, cooling down by natural circulation using gravity and buoyancy. So this has, but this feature cannot be retrofitted in existing reactors. So in existing reactors, you just have to make sure that you have reliable power source from one, two, three, you know, backup systems. And the other, you know, the technology has significantly changed in the sense that now I hear all these concerns that they do not have sensors, they do not know how much radiation is at different locations, they cannot see if there's water in there or not. Of course, in a circumstance like this, when there have been multiple fires, et cetera, some of those equipment that I'm going to mention may not work, but any system like this, you can just put webcams in plenty of places. There were no webcams in 1971 when this Japanese reactor was built, but today we can put wireless systems, wireless detectors, transmitting signals wirelessly, and try to make them robust enough so that at least you know, some of them might be functioning, and they're not very costly.
We're at our midpoint here already. We have a number of callers, and we want to get right to them. Let me introduce again our guests, Drs. Rizwan Uddin and James Stubbins. They're both professors in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at University of Illinois. We're talking about the continuing Japanese nuclear crisis, something about how it happened and how they're trying to deal with it, and perhaps what sort of lessons can be learned. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is our first caller, and that would be in Belgium, I believe, line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Such a sad morning that it is. You've mentioned a lot of things that happen with maybe not totally thought out, maybe not totally considered in every way. But there was one thing that I wonder if it was totally overlooked in the beginning. I can't understand why it happened. You have a failure in a nuclear power plant, and you have a crisis. Well, why in the world would you put six of them side by side? So if one fails, you got a problem. When the second one fails, you don't have twice the problem. You got more than twice the problem. Then we got the third, the fourth, and maybe even the fifth and sixth. Sounds to me like there should have been not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Well, I think to start the answer that there is some economy in putting these closer together so that they can be serviced by the same crew of people and share practices. It's not clear to me, at least at this point, even that there's been any interplay between these systems. So even if they were spaced apart by a kilometer, even as much as a kilometer or something, and had the same configuration, I think we would see similar problem, but with larger spacing between them. It seems to me that what's happened in each of the cases has individually caused the damage in each of the reactors, not that one has led to the damage in another.
No, sir. What I was meaning is they're all six very close together. Why not put one 100 miles away and 100 miles that way? You know, so they're very widely spaced.
I guess there are, again, a couple parts of the answer there. One of the things is that the siting of these reactors is always close to some body of water, so you need some necessary cooling. So putting them on the coast in Japan seems the most reasonable thing to do. In the U.S., we put them on lakes or rivers. Typically, we also have some on the coast. But the other issue is that siting of these reactors is not an easy issue typically. There are all kinds of environmental and social impact studies that are done to prepare it, well, to even have a site licensed for having reactors. And so once you've found a site that's suitable, quite often, even in the U.S., many places in the world, people will put at least two units on the site if they can.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go on to another caller. This is Champaign County, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm interested to know if any of you know that there was a siting fight just recently in Japan that broke into street fighting, a pitched battle between environmentalists and TEMCO, and just the prior week about siting another plant on in an area that the environmentalists thought was earthquake prone. All of Japan is earthquake prone, but for the people that are there who have been fighting for a while the siting and maybe just nuclear power in particular, this is particularly tragic for them. I wanted to ask you about the model Mark One. There's some testimony on the Hill a while back that's not gotten a lot of note, but it's a very benighted device. I think the oldest one is Dresden here on the Illinois River, and it had its license renewed, and it's much past its renewal date. Vermont, who are going to shut theirs down, the operator there has been caught in lying about even how the plant is built. They denied that there were pipes underground that could be leaking tritium. It was leaking tritium. There were pipes underground. This is the same model, too. And the NRC, just the day before the disaster in Japan, licensed it, even though they know the governor is against it. The legislator are going to phase it out. So it just seems to me that I think you should overview what's going on in the U.S. and how many spent fuel pools comparable to this are there. Just one other thing. I know this is a lot, but I still have a lot more. I understand that TEMCO didn't even have, like, boron or any kind of borate or boric acid solution that the U.S. military actually hustled in with something to try to suppress the neutron flux. Is that typical, that a plant would not have something, a neutron flux-killing device for extreme circumstances? There's also one thing that's being said a lot that I just want to address, too, that it was the tsunami that was the final blow. We don't know that. The earthquake itself was so massive, and we probably never will know really for sure what kind of structural damage was caused by that. I know the diesel fuel tanks supposedly washed away with the tsunami, and that's why they had some trouble. But all those diesels actually burnt out and had to be replaced rather quickly. So they were testing them, but apparently not a test that actually showed that they would work in the kind of usage that they failed in.
Well, the caller has given us a lot to talk about. Let me maybe start with asking you to respond to the questions about this particular design of plant. The plant here, the ones that we actually were talking about, they were designed by General Electric.
Yes.
This is known as the Mark One. This plant went into service in 1971, and it seems, at least from what I read, that almost from the beginning there were questions about the design, this particular design, and whether there are problems with it.
Yeah, so I guess I can say I'm not so familiar with the design problem issues or the other issues that the caller raised specifically about these siting problems in Japan. Mm-hmm. It's true that as these reactors were built, the first of these was brought online in 1971. I think the last is maybe 76, 77, 78. So there was a series of construction. But as these plants were built, General Electric and other reactor vendors tended to make improvements in the design to try and make the designs better. And so if you look at later versions of boiling water reactors, they will have an upgraded design from these particular ones. I don't know specifically about problems, but the experience has been, I think, in general positive with these reactors. I haven't gone back and looked at the history of the Fukushima plant operations. But just knowing what I know about operational procedures here in Japan, the U.S., for instance, learned a lot about operations. We were only reasonably effective in keeping the plants up and running all of the time in the period of the 70s and 80s. And through the 90s and now, we've become much more efficient at doing this. Mm. We've been much more careful about the kind of planned maintenance and these kinds of things.
Well, what about the problem of expected plant life and the fact that we do now have plants that are past the point where it was originally thought when they were built that they would be decommissioned by this point? Is that a problem?
Well, the way the plant life extension works is that you have to apply for a plant life extension, and you have to basically go through a licensing process more or less like you went through before, which means that you have to show that the plant will operate up to the design specifications for any continuing period. And so this is one of the major efforts in the U.S. now to extend life. I think the people that designed these plants, even the ones that are the date back to the late 60s, early 70s, will tell you that the designs were extremely conservative and that a 40-year design life was what they thought was a reasonable bound, but with this experience, people think that it, you know, 60 years now, there's even talk in some cases of going beyond 60 years for licensing. The license, even when this license extension is granted, you have to continually show that you're meeting the license requirements. You don't get 20 years and then you're off the hook for doing any kind of reporting or upgrades or anything. You're continually doing that, and this is continually looked at.
Okay.
And so the way it goes with NRC is that NRC will look at the plant, and the burden will be on the utility to convince the NRC that every part of that plant is going to last another 20 years. And NRC has specifically identified certain bottlenecks. And in many cases, for example, NRC will tell the utility that, okay, such and such part should be replaced because it is really coming to the end of its life, near 40 years. And the list is given to the utility. Then they have to go through all those changes that need to be upgraded. And then it goes back to the NRC, and NRC then at some point certifies the life extension. Maybe NRC, I'm sure NRC people are still, you know, as we speak, going through that list again to make sure that they're not missing something. Mm. But in my opinion, it's a fairly rigorous process. And it's the kind of thing that, I mean, in my mind, I mean, if you go back and look at specifically, first of all, this particular event, what's happening in Japan, there are some very, very obvious first issues that come to mind. Okay, that are very specific to that particular event. And then we have to sit down and start thinking about, okay, what other possible combination of events can take place? Okay, that might be specific to some other sites. And we just need to make sure that we address those very well. As far as the earthquake part was concerned, I think overall, not specific to nuclear reactor building, but the Japanese building code has been extremely, in my mind, looking at those buildings that all withstood this 8.9 earthquake, they were all washed away by, even the tiny houses, they were washed away by the tsunami, and it wasn't the earthquake. So there might have been some damage to the reactor building due to the earthquake, but I think that was not the big bottleneck.
I want to come back to the subject of spent fuel, but I have another caller here who's been very patient and been waiting for a while, so rather not make them wait longer in Lovington, and that would be line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question is, how are they going to encapsulate those to essentially kill them in the long term?
That's a good question, because it would seem that, at least from what I have heard, that the seawater that they're trying to use, that they're using to cool the plant, will damage it irreparably, so that it's not something that you can't fix it. You won't be able to use it.
I think the seawater alone probably is not the only problem, but the temperatures and other kinds of things. So I think the lesson here is what happened maybe at Three Mile Island, where there was also partial fuel melting. We think it's also happened in the Fukushima plants. And as long as the pressure vessel and the outer the containment, the primary, what's called the primary containment, stay intact, these plants can be isolated in that form until things cool substantially, and then it would be possible to take them apart and take the fuel that's been degraded out. There was a lot of effort to figure out how to do this at Three Mile Island, so those techniques have been perfected to keep doses down, to keep other problems from arising, and it would be disposed of. Once they're shut down and cool, there's no immediate need to do anything to take them apart. I think that process can be done in a very thoughtful way as long as the plants are cooled down and everything's contained.
Well, is that what is happening here similar to what happened in Chernobyl?
No, Chernobyl is – so this is maybe an important point for the listeners. The Chernobyl reactor had several major differences. First of all, this plant has outside the fuel. The fuel has its own kind of containment, this cladding that people worry about maybe bursting in the spent fuel pools. But there is a major steel pressure vessel surrounding the reactor core. So that's one line of containment. And surrounding the reactor, this big steel pressure vessel, there's also a concrete and steel structure, so-called primary containment. Chernobyl had neither of these. Chernobyl had a reactor core that was basically open that had tubes running through it to produce the steam. So instead of having a pressure vessel around the core, they had basically these pressure kind of tubes that had pressurized steam running through the core and no containment over the whole structure. So the problem in Chernobyl came when the steam pressure built up so high that basically it blew the core apart. As soon as it blew the core apart, it was exposed to air and there were tremendous fires. And so that kind of structure and containment system was completely absent in Chernobyl and is absolutely necessary for all Western reactors. You can't find all the reactors in Japan have this pressure vessel surrounded by the primary containment. All the ones in the U.S. have the same kind of structures.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Just one little addition to that. There was also graphite in the Chernobyl reactor, which catches fire very easily, and the graphite does not exist in any of the plants in the U.S. or in Japan.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's another good point. The graphite is, we said at the very outset that the water is there inside the core to do two things. It slows the neutrons down and it removes the heat. In the Chernobyl plant, the graphite was there to slow the neutrons down and the water was there to remove the heat. So when the heat couldn't be removed anymore, the neutrons were still getting slowed down. The reactions were still going. And so this was another design fault of that kind of plant that we don't have in the U.S. With U.S. reactors, the Japanese reactors, same basic design. The hotter they get internally, the more they try and shut themselves down. So they have an internal mechanism for trying to avoid overheating. As they overheat, the reactions start to slow down and the reactor itself should start to shut down.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Chernobyl, what they had to do was they had to set up essentially an exclusion zone in an area around the plant where they said no one can go there, or if you do, maybe with the right kind of protection, you can be there for very short amounts of time, and then it's more critical as you get closer and closer and closer to the reactor because the radiation levels will go up the closer you get.
In addition, they built a sarcophagus around the plant itself, which has also been problematic because the structure hasn't maintained good stability.
So with the Fukushima plant, then does that mean that they're also going to have to establish some sort of zone? Once the hope is that once they get cooled down, that they're going to have to be some area on the plant where they're simply going to have to say, well, people aren't, if they had lived there before, they're not going to be able to live there now.
Well, I think this really depends on the type of release and the extent of the release. In the Chernobyl plant, everything went up. And so all of the stuff that was in the fuel went up and deposited around the area. What's happened, at least from what we understand so far in this case, is the gases that are generated in the core. Some of these are noble gases like xenon and krypton. And the other ones that people worry or hear and worry a lot about are iodine and cesium. These things are will elute or come out with the steam that comes out and the hydrogen we saw, which is the source probably of the explosions. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that might give some exposure. All of the rest of the things, we hope, as long as the system stays together, will be contained inside the fuel, we're hoping, inside the pressure vessel, as long as that stays intact, and inside the primary containment. And so all of that should be contained. This is the goal of all of this heat removal, you know, water spraying and all of these actions that are going on now, to keep that contained.
Our guest in this hour of focus is James Stubbins and Drs. Rizwan Uddin. They are both professors in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the continuing nuclear crisis in Japan, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to one of the other questions the previous caller raised about the spent fuel that's being stored on site at nuclear plants. The United States government was involved in a decades-long effort to construct a permanent storage site that would take this material. And they built a place in Nevada, Yucca Mountain, and it's not happening. Yucca Mountain is not happening for a variety of reasons. So it seems that we're right back to square one on this particular issue. What are we going to do with this material? In the meantime, it's being stored on site. And the question is, how long can that continue to work? How long can nuclear plants continue to store the material on site?
This has again been a really complicated social, political, technical issue in the U.S. Yeah. And if you go back to when these plants were initially designed, the thought at the time was you would put the reactor in, together, you would put the fuel in the reactor. When it burned, you would do this switching of a third of the core each time, put that third in the spent fuel pool. It should reside there probably on the order of 5 years. After 5 years, it would be taken out of that system. And in the days when this reactor was built, the thought was that this would go off for reprocessing, just mm-hmm. like the French do, and actually the Japanese also. So the resident time in the spent fuel pool would be 5 years. There would be active cooling. What's happened in the U.S. Is that there hasn't been any. There was a decision to go away from reprocessing in the late 70s in the Jimmy Carter administration. And this effort to try and build a repository started just after that, in the early days of the Reagan administration. But without that repository, the spent fuel pools have filled up, and they've actually been reconfigured so that you could put more fuel in them than more spent fuel in than they were initially designed to hold by putting boron, borated things in. So this was one of the earlier questions about boron injection. And so this has been done. Now there has been a movement, since these pools are full, to take the oldest fuel, which is cooled for, in some cases, 10, 20, 30 years, and put these in dry casks in a configuration where they could be loaded in with several fuel elements, but not a large number, but a number that's enough to fill a cask, and then put these casks outside the reactor where they can be watched. Mm-hmm. Outside the containment, out next near the reactor, but on the reactor site someplace. Mm-hmm. And this looks like it's going to be at least the interim solution to dealing with the spent fuel for the foreseeable future in the U.S.
Just maybe to come back, and I know this is getting kind of complicated to talk about the issue of reprocessing, that essentially what that means is to take this spent fuel, and what you can do is to do something to it so that then you can reuse it. But it seemed that the reason that the decision was made to move away from reprocessing was that it can also produce material that could be used in a nuclear weapon, and this was a proliferation issue. Right.
I think this was at least the public perception. In fact, the plutonium that you get out of nuclear fuel is not so good for making weapons. It's not good for making nuclear weapons. It's still not nasty things, and so you don't want people to have their hands on it. But this is an evolutionary thing. In the days when reactors were young, people thought there wasn't probably enough uranium to supply all of the reactors that would be built. And so a reasonable thing to do would be to burn the fuel, take it out, reprocess it, and take the parts out that are still useful. Natural uranium doesn't contain very much of the part of uranium that is the useful part for the fuel. So natural uranium has to be enriched. But when you burn it in the reactor, you produce some plutonium from this other uranium that's not so good. Mm-hmm. And that plutonium also actually is also very good fuel for reactors. And so the intention was to take out the unburned part of the useful uranium and the plutonium, use that to make new fuel elements. And so you wouldn't be wasting that basically very valuable material. What's happened since is uranium prices have dropped, and it's more economical, actually, just to enrich the uranium, put it in the reactor, burn it, and then deal with the back end of the fuel cycle, what happens with the spent fuel later. Mm-hmm. At least this is in the U.S. Now, in Japan, they were reprocessing, the French reprocess. This doesn't completely remove the long-term storage problem because there are still things that need to be stored.
Yeah.
But it changes the picture about how you store, how you segregate what needs to be stored and you know, what the issues are.
And I think actually in Japan, there was particular concern about one of these reactors because it had plutonium in it. And as bad as uranium is, in terms of its radioactivity and toxicity, plutonium is worse. So they wanted to make sure of anything. They made sure of anything. It was this and I think it was reactor number three, that they kept that cool.
Yes.
So that there was no release of plutonium.
Yes, and since they have reprocessed, some of the fuel is this reprocessed fuel that has a higher level of plutonium in. Mm-hmm. And as the caller asked before, the hope would be that if everything is contained, that plutonium can't on its own evolve elute out of the system. It should be contained in the fuel. And then it becomes a problem of how you take the fuel apart later, but it's not an issue of release to the public.
Hmm. We're coming down to the last couple of minutes here. I just want to make sure if there's anything that you think is an important point that you want to make and get across that I haven't asked you about, that I give you a chance to do that. I don't know, Professor Udin, you were going to say something, and I jumped in.
I was going to just add one point to the last thing that we were talking about. That was the all fuel that is in the spent fuel pool, they have plutonium. Okay, so in this one particular case, there was plutonium that was put in deliberately in the fuel to begin with, and hence it might have little different kind of plutonium and maybe more of it. But plutonium is produced in all nuclear reactors, and when we take the spent fuel pool, out to the spent fuel pool, all of those have plutonium in them.
Okay. Yeah, and actually a good fraction of the power, maybe when you go through a fuel cycle, maybe a quarter of the power is from the plutonium you made while the fuel was in the reactor and then burned. Yeah. So actually it's generating electricity for us now in Illinois.
Well, as a result of this, in a number of countries, they're at the very least, they're taking a close look at the plants they have. Germany, there were a number of plants where they shut down those plants so that they can be inspected. In China, I think that they wanted to look at some existing plants and also, at least for the moment, put a hold on new plants. In France, they're taking a look at their plants. So clearly, there are a number of places where they've said, we just want to do what we can to make sure our plants are safe. Here in the United States, I think that for people who are really concerned about the issue of fossil fuels and global warming, people have said, well, we have to have some way to generate electricity. And if you're concerned about that, this has got to be something that at least is going to be in the mix.
Yes, and so we're in a lot of ways, even in that way, better off than Japan, because Japan has very little or no native coal. We mm-hmm. do. So sequestration might be part of the solution, but economic success stories of Japan is that they found a way to deal with these major global energy issues in their their system, using nuclear power as one of the major sources. This has helped build their economy. So, I think that even in the U.S., there will be lessons learned from this. The things that didn't go right, or the things that could have been prevented by building a wall a little bit higher, or building a more secure fuel storage tank, these kinds of things, electrical wiring issues, people will start to look at those. I'm sure that people at the NRC and all the operating plants are looking at these things right now, as soon as they learn this. And those lessons learned are part of the way the industry's improved over the years.
Hmm. And you know, it has been though a very long time since a new plant was undertaken here in the United States. Now there are some people who again were thinking, well, maybe sometime in the future we're sort of inching closer to again building some plants. This no doubt will raise questions in a lot of people's minds about whether or not it makes sense.
Yes, I'm sure. There actually is site preparation going on in a couple places. I think the most advanced place is the Vogtle site in Georgia on the coast. And so there's an anticipation that people will start building these things. I think if you look at the energy sectors in the U.S., particularly the Southeast, is starting to run into a point where they need more electrical generation capacity. Yeah. But I would agree, people will look carefully at this. I think I'm going to go back to Professor Udine's point, is that these more advanced reactor designs have safety issues that have been built into the systems that weren't necessarily thought into the systems that were built 40 years ago. The first of these now is 40 years ago at Fukushima.
Yeah. I guess just as a way, very quickly, as a way of finishing up, I suppose some people would say if nuclear power really made sense, would be have now had this decades-long hiatus in building new plants?
Well, so you know what a nuclear person will tell you is that the operational efficiency that we've gotten out of the plants in the last 10 years, that improvement, is the equivalent of having built something like 20 new plants. So with the 100 plants we had 20 years ago, it looks like we're generating the power that they would have done then with 120 plants. And there are continuing energy uprates of these plants that means that we're getting even more energy more efficiently out of these plants.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. I'm sure we'll come back to the subject on another day. But for the moment, I want to say thanks to our guests, Dr. James Stubbins and Rizwan Udine. They're both professors in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering, University of Illinois. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.